Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
Foreign ministers from Afghanistan and Pakistan met today. Nothing really unusual about that. But what was unusual? The host for that meeting. It was China. Beijing is acting as a sort of mediator between these two uneasy neighbors. And the BBC's South Asia editor Anbarasan Ethirajan joins us from London with more. And Anbarasan, why is this happening now?
This meeting was organized by China. It organized the first ever trilateral meeting involving its neighbors, Afghanistan and Pakistan. It wants to reduce the trust deficit between Kabul and Islamabad. Afghanistan accuses Pakistan of harboring Taliban militants who carry out attacks on Afghan as well as American forces and international forces who are based in Afghanistan. On the other side, Pakistan is accusing Afghanistan of harboring militants who are carrying out attacks on Pakistani forces. So China, which is emerging as a major world power now, it wants to show its regional influence, number one. And it's also playing more an active role in many of the conflicts around the world. For example, the North Korean crisis. As many people view the United States taking a backseat or retracting, you know, from getting involved in many of the world conflicts, China has started to playing a more assertive role. And this is how people see that their latest initiative on Afghanistan.
Huh. So we'll talk about that more in just a moment. But I'm also curious if China has some practical interest in reducing that trust deficit between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
First of all, China is investing nearly $60 billion in a project called China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. It runs through China and then it gets into the disputed Kashmir region and then goes all the way to southern Pakistan, giving China access to Gwadar port on the Arabian Sea. So they're building roads, railway networks and ports and also industrial parks. The second aspect is about the growing Islamist insurgency. You know, there are a number of, you know, Uyghur Chinese. They were reported to be involved in the militancy. They were found to be, you know, getting trained in the northwest of Pakistan and also in Afghanistan. Since China is also bordering Afghanistan, it's a very small border, they do not want this Islamist militancy to spill over into its Xinjiang region, which has got a sizable Muslim population. So these are the two reasons why.
Okay. So those two things in combination make a great deal of sense from the Chinese perspective. But regarding the economic corridor, what do Pakistan and Afghanistan think about that project?
For Pakistan, they think that it is a game changer because, you know, the Pakistan was affected by militancy, insurgency. The foreign investment was very low in the last few years, but the economy is picking up. It's a country of about 180 million people. It needed money. This is part of this China's One Belt, One Road initiative. It wants to connect with the Central and Southeast Asia by road and railway networks and by sea to rest of the world, what they called as the New Silk Road. So Pakistan thinks that it is strategically placed to get the Chinese funding so that it, whatever was lacking in the country for the last 10 years, it can provide job opportunities. So Pakistan hopes that this will be a game changer. This will boost its economy in the next 20 to 30 years.
So Anbarasan, to get back to what you were saying earlier about the United States being seen as sort of retreating from the world stage, it occurs to me that, you know, the United States' interest in South Asia has always been a strategic one. So that is part of the reason why there has been such a close relationship between Pakistan and the U.S. But here we have China's interest in the region also being a strategic and economic one. So, you know, from the point of view of Afghanistan and Pakistan, which nation, China or the United States, is sort of the better good faith arbiter or negotiator to help reduce these tensions that you're talking about?
even though the United States has been involved in Afghanistan, but still the United States trying to get a sense of what is happening on the ground. You know, the troops went up to more than 150,000 there. They were fighting the Taliban insurgency. Now the troops are reduced to around 10,000. And following President Trump's new Afghan strategy, the troop numbers are going up. But still, again, a trust deficit between the United States and Pakistan. The U.S., even last month, was very categorical. President Trump toughened its policy towards Pakistan, saying there should not be any safe havens for militants or terrorists inside Pakistan. So Pakistan seems to be believing, or it is trusting more in China in terms of trying to bring peace, because it feels the economic benefits of this corridor can be extended to Afghanistan. That's what China is proposing. And that will lure Afghanistan into strike a peace deal with Pakistan as well.
Interesting. The carrot rather than the stick here. Well, that's the BBC's South Asia editor, Anbarisan Ethirajan, speaking to us from London. Thank you so very much.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
Well, in California, the sale of recreational marijuana becomes legal on Monday, and many businesses are positioning themselves to profit from the state's new green rush. The city of Oakland is trying to pave the way for aspiring black entrepreneurs to sell pot, especially those who have faced harsh consequences for selling drugs illegally in the past. Alyssa Jung Perry of KQED has our story.
Linda Grant has lived in East Oakland for most of her life.
Right down here at Elmhurst Elementary School on 98th, I went to junior high school.
And that's where she got into the weed business a long time ago.
We stayed on the football field all day selling weed to each other, selling dollar joints, selling $5 bags of weed.
Grant's 48 now. She's a grandmother, and she's still in the game, operating underground. So inevitably, she's had some run-ins with the law, like in 1994.
I just remember, like, they saying, yeah, you're going to jail for a long time for this weed. And I'm like, what? It's only a $5 bag of weed, $10 maybe. And I just remember them threatening my whole life freedom over that weed, just taunting me. The police officers like, oh, yeah, you going. You can kiss your kids goodbye. You're going to jail for so long. You ain't going to see sunlight again. It was horrible.
Being black and getting arrested for cannabis isn't unusual in Oakland. According to a city report, 77% of those arrested for cannabis in 2015 were black, though black people make up just one-third of Oakland's population. Darlene Flynn is the head of the city's Department of Race and Equity.
Certain communities have been policed for the same activities because we know that white people use drugs and sell drugs at approximately the same rate that black and brown people do, but they don't get jailed at the same rate.
Now, Oakland's trying to right that wrong.
We certainly can't fix everything that has happened in the past, but what we can say is going forward, how can we make things more fair?
So the city has started an equity cannabis permit program. That means when the city of Oakland starts handing out permits for legal pot businesses, it will give priority to people who have been convicted for cannabis and to people like Linda Grant, who live in parts of the city that have the highest number of marijuana-related arrests. And Flynn says the city is trying to counteract another inequity. While some parts of Oakland have been disproportionately policed for weed, she says other neighborhoods have been allowed to embrace cannabis opportunities without penalty.
Literally another geographic part of the city that was where we have concentrations of people who are not people of color, being able to run universities and workshops and be very out in the open about cultivating their entrepreneurialism.
But for Oakland's equity applicants, moving from the underground to the legal marketplace may not be easy. More than 100 people have started the process, but the city says they have yet to issue any licenses. In part, that's because there's a lot of hoops to jump through. Grant says she still needs to get a business license, lease a legitimate workspace, and
they want tax returns and stuff like that. I don't have no receipts from selling weed. I haven't worked legally.
Then there's another requirement. You have to make less than $53,000 a year, which is low in the Bay Area. James Anthony is a local medical cannabis lawyer. He says it's hard for people with little income to start any kind of business.
They have no money. They have no access to land. They don't have commercial property. They don't have startup capital. It's a very, very difficult task, and I'm not sure how the city is going to solve all those problems.
But Linda Grant is determined to make this work. Her goal is to be the first Black woman to own a dispensary in East Oakland.
I think my experience and my background makes me eligible to own a dispensary because I have been in a cannabis club business. So illegal or not illegal, I still know what to do.
But Grant and Oakland need to act fast because lots of businesses with lots of money have already prepared themselves to cash in when sales of recreational marijuana get underway. For Here and Now, I'm Melissa Jung Perry in San Francisco.
And an update, the city of Oakland has awarded Linda Grant a provisional permit to run a cannabis delivery service. Well, another story we're following, the White House announced this week that it's removing an enormous magnolia tree from the grounds in front of the South Portico. It's been there for nearly 200 years. The decision to remove the tree is based on the recommendation of specialists from the National Arboretum who say that the tree is too delicate for another steel pole or cables to be installed to hold it up. The tree was planted by former President Andrew Jackson. The Washington Post reports the magnolia was the favorite tree of his wife. The seedling came from the Jacksons' Tennessee farm. The tree has been witness to a lot of history. There were presidential chats in its shade. It was even featured on the back of the $20 bill from 1928 to 1998. The magnolia will live on in a way. Michelle Obama took a seedling from it to the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 2009 so that it could grow at the USDA's community garden. And CNN reports that another seedling will be planted in the place of the magnolia tree, hopefully for the next 200 years. ...2017 was a big year for science. There were some important breakthroughs in medicine and in our understanding of the universe. And NPR science correspondent Joe Palca joins us now to take a look at a few of the year's highlights. Hi, Joe.
Howdy.
And let's start with the iceberg that broke off the Larsen C ice shelf on the Antarctic Peninsula in July. Do we know what caused that break?
Well, I mean, I think that you have to keep in mind that this ice shelf is calving icebergs all the time. What I particularly liked about this story, though, is that if you read a European description of it, it's an iceberg the size of Luxembourg. But if you read a U.S. description, it's an iceberg the size of Delaware. So you get
right.
your pick. But these things happen. And, of course, everybody's, you know, quick to say, oh, must be global warming. Let's see. That's got to be. But truth is, it's a little hard to say for sure. As I say, this kind of thing happens.
But this one was seen as very significant.
Well, it was because it was huge. I mean, Luxembourg isn't that big, but it's still pretty big for a piece of ice. And the one thing, though, that you have to keep in mind is that this ice shelf is actually floating in the ocean. So when this breaks off, it's not like a new chunk of something falls into the sea. It's actually not going to raise sea level. But if the whole Larsen C ice shelf should collapse, then there's a chance that the icebergs behind it would come into the sea, and that could significantly raise sea level around the world. So, yeah, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. I'm just saying it's not unheard of.
All right. Another one that made your list this year is the neutron star collision that was detected by LIGO, the Advanced Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. Tell us more, first of all, about that. What did they discover?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on saying the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave
yes.
Observatory. That was very good. So what they discovered was this amazing a thing that Einstein predicted in his general theory of relativity, that if two huge, massive objects were to merge together, there would be a brief ripple in space-time known as a gravitational wave. But Einstein thought that these things would be so faint that they would never be detected. Other people thought differently, and with modern technology and lasers and interferometers, they were able to see, in quotes, this gravitational wave ripple past the Earth. And it was exactly the shape that Einstein predicted for this kind of event. So it was just awesome, spectacular science, I thought.
Well, and I encourage people to go and Google LIGO because you can see the way that we detect these gravitational waves. There's one
big, huge arm out in Washington State, and there's another one in Louisiana, and that's what makes it happen. Now, the people behind LIGO, or some of them, Barry Barish and Kip Thorne of Caltech and Rainer Weiss at MIT, got the Nobel Prize in Physics this year because of LIGO. Do you expect that we're going to be hearing more about LIGO, about gravitational waves in the coming years as they discover more things?
Well, I've thought deeply about this question, and I think I know how to answer it. Yes. yes, it is stunning what this is going to do to open up a new field of physics. The Nobel Prize Award went for the machine. I mean, these guys weren't alone, of course, but they were the architects of the LIGO Observatory. But the things that LIGO will reveal are things that were impossible to imagine before. So if you ask me, are they going to discover new things? I'm going to say they're going to discover things that we didn't even know were out there to be discovered. The neutron star collision was so interesting because not only did they see a gravitational wave, but they saw X-rays and gamma rays and radio waves and ultraviolet light and infrared light all coming from the same spot. So they were able to study this in many different physical ways, and they've learned a lot about what happens when a neutron star collides with two neutron stars merge.
Okay, another item on your list, another big breakthrough this year, the gene editing system called CRISPR was used to modify human embryos. Tell us more.
Well, this was a team in Oregon. Actually, Chinese scientists had done something similar in the past. This was a team in Oregon. And, oh, my goodness, you know, this is the very sensitive topic. So think about it, Jeremy. If you and your wife want to have a child and you both have a rare genetic disease, you would be happy not to pass that genetic disease on to your child, right? So there is a way that you can use in vitro fertilization to create an embryo in a test tube and then test that embryo for the disease mutation. And if it's there now, what this guy is saying is we can fix it. It's one gene. It's one problem. We could fix it. And then the embryo is healthy. And you put that back into your wife in this case. And off you go to have a pregnancy and a healthy baby. That sounds great. And it is great in principle. But you have just done something where you have permanently modified the human germline. That thing is no longer part of that line of genetics. And so some people say, well, hang on, that sounds great when you're doing that. But what if there's a gene for amblyopia or something like that? Do we want to take that out of the population? That's a disease where you don't see as well with both eyes. I mean, there are all kinds of questions about whether we want to go ahead and modify human beings in the test tube. And there's no take back. You can't undo it once you've done it. And so it has raised a lot of interesting questions. Now, I have to quickly say the experiment in Oregon was never intended to be implanted in a human. It was just to show that the embryos grew for a few days and they were destroyed. So it was to show it was possible. Even there, I guess it's ethically and morally fraught because some people feel you shouldn't be doing experiments on embryos and then destroying them. But it was a remarkable example of what's possible with this new genetic tool called CRISPR, which can modify genes in living organisms.
Okay, one of the most memorable events of the year is on your list. That was the total solar eclipse on August 21st. Let's listen here to Chris Lehman of Oregon Public Broadcasting on our show that day, describing the eclipse in Salem, Oregon.
Oh, yeah. It's just about disappearing. There's just a tiny little bit left, a tiny little bit. And, oh, boy, it's getting dark here. There it is.
Now, this was the first eclipse to cross North America in 99 years. What did we learn from it?
We learned that people really go nuts about eclipses. That's what we learned from it. I think it was just an amazing phenomenon that absolutely, I have to say, as a scientific phenomenon, yes, it's very interesting. Solar physicists were delighted. But I can bet you that most people weren't excited by all the science that was going to come out of it. They were excited by, wow, this is just amazing to see. And it was. I mean, you heard it. People experience something that's just remarkable. When the eclipse occurs, there's parts of the sun's atmosphere that become visible, and you can study them in a way you can't do normally. So, yes, there's a lot of interesting solar physics. But honestly, it was just the social phenomenon, I think, that made it such an amazing event.
I was in probably the worst place to watch the eclipse, which was Acadia National Park in Maine. A beautiful place, but also very far away from the, you know, the main event of the eclipse that day.
Well, I was in an even worse place. I was in this studio talking to your co-host.
Right. Well, but the thing that I liked about it was we were out at a restaurant, and a few people had those little glasses that you can look through to see the eclipse. And every single person at the restaurant and every single member of the staff came out to take a couple of seconds look at it. And it was really, it was a nice way to experience it, even though it didn't get dark or anything like that.
Absolutely. I did, too. When I wasn't in the studio, we ran out to the roof of NPR and we all had glasses and were looking up. So it was everywhere. It was amazing.
Okay, another big moment was NASA's Cassini spacecraft, which crashed into Saturn in September. Here's a clip of the project manager, Earl Mays, announcing the end of the Cassini mission.
Congratulations to you all. This has been an incredible mission, an incredible spacecraft, and you're all an incredible team. I'm going to call this the end of mission. Project manager, off the net.
Tell us about the significance of this spacecraft crashing into Saturn.
Well, the crashing was an interesting way to end the mission. The reason was that the spacecraft could maybe possibly have had some organisms from Earth still stuck to it, and they really didn't want it to crash into Titan or Enceladus, two of Saturn's moons, because they had begun to see evidence that those moons could possibly, maybe possibly harbor some form of life. And the last thing they wanted to do was contaminate another planet's life with some junk from Earth. So they said, okay, we're just going to have it destroyed, which it did when it went into Saturn. It burned up and then got crushed. So nothing happening after that. But the mission itself, as I said, it discovered these amazing things about Saturn's moons. It showed all sorts of interesting things about the rings of Saturn. They learned about how the solar system formed. And it was just an amazing mission, 13 years in orbit around Saturn, and it had to end. And hearing that tape, I was in the control room at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. It was emotional. I mean, yeah. People were in there crying, you know, losing this mission after so many years.
That's NPR's science correspondent Joe Palca, and we will link you to his list of the top stories of the year in science at hereandnow.org. Joe, thanks so much.
Oh, it was great.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the Trump administration is planning to roll back some offshore oil drilling regulations. The rules were put in place after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Emily Glazer is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. She joins us now. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we all remember the Deepwater Horizon spill. 11 workers were killed. 200 million gallons of oil were spilled into the Gulf of Mexico. First of all, what were the regulations that were put in place after that disaster that the Trump administration now wants to change?
So Deepwater Horizon is the biggest oil spill in U.S. history. My colleagues reported around April 2014 that the Obama administration put in regulations that were designed to prevent some of the equipment failures that occurred on Deepwater Horizon. So that included things like imposing new standards on equipment designed to keep control of a well and required real-time monitoring on certain kinds of drilling undertaken in deep water or under high pressure.
And have these regulations done what they were intended to do?
You know, it depends who you ask. My colleague Ted Mann reported that after President Trump took office, industry groups flooded the agency that regulates offshore oil and gas drilling, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, with suggested rollbacks to the so-called well control rule. And the proposed government rollbacks that we reported on earlier this week would actually give those industry groups much of what they've sought.
Yeah, the body in charge of regulation, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, says the changes could save the industry more than $900 million in the next 10 years. Has the industry really been hurt by these regulations?
You know, in general, when industries become more heavily regulated, and I've seen this a lot, you know, covering businesses over types of years, they have to pay for the new processes and measures that are taking place. And that often costs a lot of money to get there. The industry groups in this case would argue that, yes, you know, those costs have hurt them, whereas environmentalists would argue that the additional regulations are necessary to prevent another crisis down the line.
Well, and of course, a spill like the one that we saw that everybody watched for like about a month on TV and on the internet, you could see that oil just coming out of the ground. That obviously had a big environmental toll as well. If there is another spill, if these regulations get cut, who foots the bill for that?
You're totally right, Jeremy. And, you know, if memory serves correct, Deepwater Horizon, that well leaked for 87 days
right.
and poured at least 3.19 million barrels of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. So to put some numbers in context, BP said in mid-2016 that Deepwater Horizon cost it around $62 billion pre-tax. That's around $44 billion after tax. That includes anything from several settlements with federal and state authorities, shareholders, property owners, consumers. We're talking motels in Mississippi, shrimp fishermen,
right.
The EPA. And it really did foot a lot of the damage, whether it was medical costs, property damage, economic losses, and cleanup. So in that case, BP did pay a lot. It's hard to know what would happen if another spill occurs down the line, since so much of this is circumstantial, though.
And just a few seconds, but is there opposition to the change in the rules?
So this has run into some funny holiday timing where the Wall Street Journal article posted on Christmas Day. So we haven't seen too much opposition yet. And our reporting was about a proposal that isn't public. So I'd expect some down the line, though.
That's Emily Glazer of The Wall Street Journal. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Humans love to build, and we love to make buildings and structures that capture the imagination and seem to defy time. But those structures do fall to the passage of time, to conquest, or to terrorism. So what can their stories tell us? James Crawford tells 21 of those architectural histories in his book, Fallen Glory, The Lives and Deaths of History's Great Buildings. We spoke with him when the book was first published, and we started by talking about the history of a structure from the ancient world, Palmyra in Syria, which had been destroyed by the Islamic State.
It really grew up and reached the sort of an incredible level of opulence over a very short period from about 20 AD up to about 200 AD. And it was built on money and trade because the flow of goods between the Roman and the Sasanian empires moved through this kind of desert oasis. The only way to go between the two was through the city. So they were sort of part of the Roman Empire, but they had a large degree of autonomy at the same time. And basically they taxed the flow of goods and became fabulously wealthy as a result. And I think the Romans viewed them as slightly tacky and a bit nouveau riche in terms of how they developed.
You know, it's interesting, though, because this crossroads of history nature that Palmyra embodies is one of the things, one of the reasons why Islamic State fighters proceeded to destroy, or they say destroy, you know, much of the ancient ruins. I mean, in the words of those fighters, they say the ruins were created by, quote, devil worshippers. I mean, so it's like it's very the city's own history comes back to haunt it.
It does. I mean, I think Islamic State are sort of apply an incredibly crude understanding of history, perhaps deliberately, because they don't really care. I mean,
right.
One of the reasons I think they attacked Palmyra so vociferously is because the Western press were so appalled, and us being appalled helped their cause. So they continued to kind of demolish the building systematically. And then, you know, they're a very kind of propaganda savvy organization, if you like. I wouldn't even give them the benefit of calling them a state. And they were using that. The reason they were using it is because we have such emotive connections to buildings. And in many ways, that's what my book is about, is that sense that, you know, we sort of shout with joy when we raise buildings up and we weep with sorrow when we destroy them. And we do continue to destroy them all over the world all the time. And the lives and particularly deaths of buildings have an enormous impact on global politics today still.
Well, let's move forward to another grand piece of architecture that you write about, whose destruction was actually celebrated rather than mourned. And this is the Berlin Wall, which went up in 1961 pretty much overnight. Now, you call it the Mirror Wall. Why is that?
I kind of call it that because, to me, the Berlin Wall was always this sort of dark fairy tale that I was aware of. And it was this sense that you had a city of opposites divided in two. And on one side, on the west side, the wall was there to keep people in. And on the east side, they perceived it as being there to keep people out, to keep this sort of aggressive, militaristic West out. So there's a sense that when each side looked at the wall, they saw themselves reflected back rather than understanding what was going on. And of course, this divided a city, but it also divided the world. You know, it was very much the split between capitalism and communism, between East and West. It was the epicenter of the Cold War. It was such an emotive and powerful symbol. And of course, walls are very much in vogue again right now. So it's a very interesting one for us to talk about today.
Well, in fact, if I can just jump in here, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. Because in your book, you write that, you know, in the 1980s, of course, people remember that Ronald Reagan famously said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Mm. You write that the very idea of a wall that could, quote, act as a serious barrier between people had become an almost comic anachronism. But as you point out, the pendulum has swung very strongly in the other direction, and walls are seen as something that's desirable to separate people again.
I mean, I think there still is an element that it's a comic anachronism, and satirists are getting a lot of joy out of the very concept of the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. But I think the interesting thing about it is the wall was only brought down after there was a realization that it was a nonsense. You know, it was a kind of diplomatic error that led to the people in the East believing that the checkpoints had been opened and that the border was clear for access and for passing through. So it was a psychological barrier. I mean, initially it wasn't even a wall. It was actually rolls and rolls of barbed wire. And over time, it gradually became a wall. But it was always perceived as a wall because on that night in November 1989, when the wall fell, it didn't fall. But people came together. They stood on top of it. They danced. They kissed. They hugged. And suddenly it was gone. And then it was over the sort of subsequent period that it was systematically torn down. But at the time that it was actually being torn down, a lot of people in East and West Berlin suddenly faced with this absence. They had 1 in 3 West Berliners and 1 in 4 East Berliners saying they actually wanted the wall back because it played such an enormous part of their lives. So while as a physical structure, it's kind of a nonsense, it exists as an ideological, a political, and a psychological structure.
I feel like this is actually the perfect segue to one of the last chapters that I want to talk with you about, because you dedicate a chapter to a city or a structure that doesn't actually exist in the physical world. It was purely digital. And that is GeoCities, which I imagine there are a lot of listeners right now who are hearing this and saying, what? Because they're too young to even remember what it was. But can you remind us, what was GeoCities?
Yeah, GeoCities was effectively the very first internet city, and I suspect also the very last internet city. It was developed in the mid-1990s. Its kind of creators wanted to try and give people a way of navigating and understanding the internet in its formative years. And they thought the best way to do that was to give people addresses. And they placed those addresses within the sort of structural concept of a city. So you lived in a district or a suburb that was related to your interests. So that might be sport, it might be fashion, it might be history, it might be music, it might be politics. So you had this address, and you had, at the time, you know, 2 megabytes of space is effectively what you bought. And you were an internet homesteader. And it became, you know, within 2 years, it went from no citizens to 1 million citizens. It was the fastest growing city in human history. And there was an attempt to monetize it. It was bought by Yahoo, and Yahoo failed to monetize it and ultimately switched it off. But in switching off, they perpetrated one of the greatest acts of cultural destruction, if you like, that's ever occurred. Because people had put all their data up there, it wasn't backed up, and it was wiped out in an instant.
Huh. Do you really think that destruction carried the same lasting impact as, you know, the destruction of other things we've been talking about, like the Berlin Wall or Palmyra? Because as we're underscoring, GeoCities existed entirely on the internet.
I think there was a lot of creative material were put up on that. You know, people, this was the development of personal web pages. It's almost like your Facebook profile page. So people were putting photographs up there. They were putting poems up there, you know, it's early blogging, all this material which historians maybe hundreds of years down the line would be able to use to understand individual voices is gone.
Right.
And there's very much this kind of danger, and people talk about this concept of a digital dark age, that because a lot of what we do now exists in this kind of digital plane. It can very easily be erased. And even though these things don't have physical presence, they have an enormous emotive presence. And in a way, this is the kind of next frontier for structures and for development. And it may be where we suffer some of the greatest losses in the future without even realizing it.
So this is one of the great takeaways that I glean from your book. And that is that buildings seem to be humankind's attempt to convince ourselves that things can be permanent in an impermanent world, because every building that we've talked about had its own lifespan and came to an end.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the very first sort of story of architecture, one of the very first stories ever written down, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is about an attempt by a mortal man to achieve immortality. And he goes on a quest to find the gods and to find the sort of the secret of immortality. And he's basically told that you're a mortal man and you will never get this. And as he returns to his city and he walks through the gate and the great walls of the city he's created, he realizes that architecture is his best shot at it. Architecture is the best way to achieve life beyond your own life. So I think that's been there from the very, very start, this understanding of legacy through what we create and through what we build.
Well, James Crawford is author of Fallen Glory, The Lives and Deaths of History's Greatest Buildings. Thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And we spoke with James Crawford last March.
It's the time of year when pictures of smiling, posing, frolicking families make their way to our mailboxes. Some of the families are very traditional, a mom, a dad, two kids, some not so traditional. An exhibition at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts explores how photographers represent different concepts of family. Andrea Shea of member station WBUR stopped by for a visit.
When you enter the museum gallery, it feels domestic. Groups of photos hang on the walls, different sizes, colors, formats, and frames, like you'd see in a living room or hallway. They span the 1800s to current day.
Photographers from the very beginning have been fascinated by the way that the camera could capture images of loved ones, freeze them in time.
MFA Photographs curator Karen Haas walks over to the oldest of more than 80 works in the exhibition, a sepia-toned daguerreotype of triplets from the 1850s. It's in a glass case next to Polaroids Andy Warhol took of the Kennedy clan on a 1972 Montauk vacation. A few paces away, Haas points out a kind of counter-image to that idealized first family. It's by Nan Golden. Curator Haas says Golden's upbringing was troubled, so the artist found a surrogate family.
In this case, two of her drag queen friends in New York City, who are members of that group that she felt and really thought of as neither male nor female, but of a sort of third gender. She was fascinated, drawn to them, they to her, and she photographed them in an incredibly loving and beautiful way.
One of the drag queens looks directly at the photographer's lens while touching the other's shoulder. Trust beams through mascaraed eyes. While Golden found family in outsider culture, other photographs in the exhibition explore being an outsider in your own family.
How do you know when you fit somewhere or when you feel like you belong? Like, what does belonging mean? Do you ever arrive at belonging, or is belonging something that you are like constantly struggling to maintain?
These are questions artist Caleb Cole probes in his photo series titled Odd One Out. For an image hanging in this show, he took a photograph he found in a thrift store and manipulated it. There's a mom in a bed, dad by her side, and they're handing a newborn baby to a dour-looking sibling. But Cole edited everyone out except for the new big sister, leaving her surrounded by white, cut-out human forms.
The look on her face to me very much said, like, I thought I understood my place. I thought I understood my role. I thought I understood where I fit. And I was, you know, this only child. And now I have to, like, renegotiate my role and how I fit. And I don't know how I feel about that.
Virtual families are here, too, in Maine-based artist Tanya Hollander's photographs. She spent 5 years tracking down hundreds of Facebook friends so she could meet them and take their pictures. Haas's goal with this exhibition is to illustrate how diverse family configurations can be without defining them.
The families that we're born into, generational families, but also romantic unions, couples, and chosen families, families we have chosen for ourselves.
The military, the church,
I think the family is such a basic social construct, so basic to so many of our lives, that I hope that these kinds of images will really resonate with people.
Visitor Sharon Gordetsky thinks they will. She's a family psychologist and former president of the Massachusetts Psychological Society, who happened to be touring the exhibition recently. She says the show is particularly valuable around the holidays, which can be rough on families that aren't traditional or picture perfect.
It's so wonderful, and for kids and everyone to come and say, you're a family, even if you're not genetically, you know, related, biologically related, you are a family.
Curator Karen Haas says these days a lot of us are walking around with our families in our phones. They're fleeting, in the cloud. She hopes this exhibition will inspire more people to break out their physical pictures and albums to look more closely at the ones we love. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Another story we're following today, the super rich are becoming richer. According to Bloomberg, the world's richest billionaires became $1 trillion richer in 2017. Amazon's Jeff Bezos, the world's richest person, added $34.2 billion to his fortune. At the end of November, Bezos' worth topped $100 billion. Microsoft's co-founder Bill Gates now has a net worth of $91 billion. And according to Bloomberg's Billionaire Index, there are now 38 Chinese billionaires who added $177 billion to their fortunes this year. Hui Kaiyan, who's founder of China Evergrande Group, that's a real estate company, added almost $26 billion to his net worth, the second biggest gain of the year, just after Jeff Bezos. And the number of Asian billionaires surpassed the number of billionaires in the U.S. for the first time ever. And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service, music courtesy of APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.